Will you pray with me? Lord, now may the words of my mouth and may the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. We are still technically in the freshness of a new year, but some of us may already be feeling behind in what we had hoped to do. And we may already be feeling disappointed in ourselves. And here we are also on the verge of newness in our national life, a change in administration, and we want to be living in hope. And yet, so many are living in the swirl of fear and anger and angst. There is disquiet in our country, maybe in our souls. What is going to happen for us personally, for our community, our communities, our country, our world in the days and years ahead? No one can say. And here we sit in the midst of all this newness, listening to these old, old, old words. Now, what are we doing this for? The words we heard this morning, they come from 2,500 something years ago. They come from the other side of the world. Yet when we listen, we find that they are still for us. And there is still a new and even living word in them. These particular words were spoken by a displaced prophet to a displaced people living in the uncertain times of exile. We call him Isaiah, though the truth is, we don't know this man's name or almost anything else about him. We only know his words. He thought of himself simply as a voice to be used by God. His words are collected with the words of the original prophet, Isaiah. The first Isaiah lived during the 8th century BCE under the Assyrian Empire. And we find his words in the first 39 chapters of the book we call Isaiah. His last recorded words at the end of chapter 39 are a warning that everything was about to change, that everything they knew would be taken from them. Jerusalem would be smashed, and many of the people in Jerusalem would be taken into exile by the king of Babylon. And so it was. In our Bibles, immediately after those words at the end of chapter 39, comes chapter 40. But in real time, there was a gap. There was this long pause of about 160 years. In fact, what happened during that gap, some have called the defining interruption of the life and faith of the people of Israel. During that gap between chapters, the Assyrian kingdom collapsed, and the Babylonian Empire rose up as the new superpower, destroyed Jerusalem, and pushed many of her people into exile. The people of Israel interpreted this devastation and deportation as God's judgment for their failed faith. So the exiles settled in, and they survived. They kept faith as best they could. They made accommodations and assimilations as they felt they needed to the culture around them. Here is the thing, though. When we think of this period in Israel's history, our focus is on those who were taken away, the exiles. But what about those who stayed behind? They were also a part of Israel. They were God's people. But we don't read their stories in our scriptures. The people who were exiled were the people who held power, position, or wealth. The people who could pose a challenge to the empire. So first, the Babylonian Empire deported the royals. And then they took away all the other officials. And then the warriors and the artists and the smiths. And no one remained except for the poor, which was probably about half the people, the ones who posed no threat to those in power. And their stories don't get told in our scriptures because there was no one left to record them. They were left behind in their destroyed homeland. They could see every day their destroyed temple. They had no political or religious leadership, no military defense, no economic base. So they lived in their own kind of wilderness, even though they were not in exile. What a hard thing it must have been when people who are trying to follow the same God end up having such vastly different experiences and understandings because of their positions in life and because of what governments do and don't do. How would these two groups of people, the exiles and the people who were left behind, ever learn to listen to each other and learn from each other? People who were carried away, people who were left behind, the community torn in two. But the truth is, this faith community had always had a kind of fracture in it. The differences between the class who had the religious and political and material power and the ones who had none of that. Those differences had always been there. The exile just revealed a fault line that had always existed. The dispersed, torn apart community lived this way for a very long time, more than a century and a half. And then one day, a voice cries out, breaking the long silence of disaster. The first words are ones that this second prophet, Isaiah, speaks on behalf of God. And they are ones that are familiar to any of us who have loved Handel's Messiah. Comfort, oh comfort, my people. The people, subject as they are to the rise and fall of superpowers, are not alone. God is powerfully present with them, and God is not silent. God has a voice, because the prophet is willing to be that voice. Today, that prophet calls again. Listen to me, he says, O coastlands. Pay attention, all you peoples far away. That could include us. And he tells the story of how he was called before he was born, named by God while he was still in his mother's womb, hidden in the shadow of God's own hand and empowered by God. given a single weapon, his words. He says, God made my mouth like a sharp sword. And God pronounces over this man his high calling. You are my servant in whom I will be glorified. It is so beautiful. It's something we all long for. This realization that we are destined for some high purpose. Something bigger than just ourselves and our own needs and preoccupations. Have you ever heard someone speak like this? I heard someone not very long ago talk about her sense of purpose in life, and she said, I was made for this. And there was so much strength and confidence in her when she said this. There was so much clarity. We all want that. The prophet has it. But here is the hard part of a high calling: living up to it. In fact, the prophet looks back at all that he has done, and he sees nothing but his failure. I have labored in vain, he says. I have spent my strength for nothing and for vanity, meaning not pride, but emptiness, nothing to show. And can't you hear his exhaustion and his discouragement and his sense of defeat? Maybe you relate to it. He is spent. And his lament is not for himself, but for his cause. He has done what he was meant to do. And it seems that nothing has come of it. It's possible that the only thing more discouraging than not knowing your purpose in life is knowing your purpose and realizing you're not living up to it. If you have ever had a just cause but felt discouraged, if you have ever been on what you were certain was the right side but still found yourself defeated, if you have ever known exactly what you were called to do but still found yourself in disillusionment and exhaustion, well, you have a kindred spirit in Isaiah. And what's more, you have an example in him. He is able to rise above his own limited human perspective and proclaim this: yet surely my cause is with the Lord, and my reward is with my God. Isaiah knows that human perspective is so finite. Human metrics are so limited. We are in no position to judge the ultimate success or failure of our best, most righteous efforts. If our work is linked with God's calling, what looks like defeat may only be prelude. The late Episcopal priest John Claypool used to tell the story of his time working in the civil rights movement and how upset he would get about the things that happened because there were so many disappointments, so many discouragements. It was a tempestuous time, and he was young. And when a bad thing happened, it seemed like the last word to him. And he would get angry and upset and exhausted. During that time, he worked alongside Abraham Heschel, the Polish-born Holocaust survivor and rabbi and theologian. Heschel had allowed the things that had happened in his life to enlighten him rather than make him bitter. And he would calm the young Claypool down by saying, "Let me tell you, son, to a Jew, there is only one unforgivable sin, and that is the sin of despair. It is saying something we have no right to say. It is suggesting that any set of circumstances is more than an ingenious God can somehow work with to make good." He said, "Despair is always presumptuous. It is saying something about reality we simply don't know enough to say." Isaiah refuses to despair, and his hope bursts through in these two words, yet surely my cause is with the Lord. Yet surely is the realization that the divine perspective subverts the power of seemingly lost causes. In God's economy, our work for justice, compassion, reconciliation is never wasted and never futile, even when we do not see what it yields. When we have a yet surely kind of faith, what follows is a but now kind of word from God. Not only has Isaiah's past work not been empty and in vain, regardless of appearances, but God has something even bigger now for him to do. "But now, thus says the Lord." And the message unfolds. Isaiah is to pull God's people back together and to gather them back to God, but not just that. That is too light a thing, God says now, which is amazing when you consider how big a thing it felt. "That is too light a thing that you should only be my servant to Israel, because I will give you as a light to the nations, that my salvation may reach to the ends of the earth." Here is God's true purpose, this broad, radically inclusive vision. Not just to gather the broken community of Israel, to shine like a light for all nations. Salvation, the full well-being that God intended for all from the beginning, pushes past the boundaries of Israel, past the horizon of the exiles, extends to every corner of creation. And it all depends on one person's willingness. In the face of what looks like failure and feels like exhaustion, to not only persist, but to dream an even bigger dream, God's dream, which includes everyone. And all Isaiah had was what God had given him, which was his words. And those words were not a small thing. They changed everything. So he kept doing what he was meant to do. And the people did come back. And they did rebuild. But the salvation that God meant for all creation did not reach the ends of the earth in Isaiah's lifetime. The temple was rebuilt, but that didn't change or fix everything. It didn't mean that all the divisions in the community of faith were healed, for instance, but it was a start. It was a sign of their desire to be one people, God's people. And then one day, 500 years later, in that very temple, a poor young mother and her new husband walked in with a little baby. And an old man who had been waiting his whole life to see a sign that God's salvation was going to extend to the ends of the earth saw the couple and their child, and he went to them and he took the baby in his arms and he said, "Lord, now you let your servant go in peace, for my own eyes have seen the salvation. Your word has been fulfilled. The salvation you have prepared in the sight of every people is here, a light to reveal you to the nations." That man was Simeon. That baby was Jesus. A little baby, but no small thing. In his teaching, the people would hear again the radical dream of God, that all people of the earth would live in compassion and wholeness and well-being and reconciliation. In his life, the people would be touched by the power of God to heal and to liberate. And in his death, the people would see what looked like the biggest failure of all turned into victory, because with God, even death is a prelude. God's vision is so much more audacious than our own. God's dream for our world and for us is bigger than we can imagine. God's perspective subverts our disappointments and our failures. We do not always live by the light we have been given, but we have seen the light, and now it is ours to share this radically inclusive, loving vision of God, of well-being for all. That light is in us now, and it is our highest purpose to reflect it, each in our own inimitable way, with whatever we've been given to share. The writer Doris Lessing once said, "Whatever you are meant to do, do it now. The conditions are always impossible." And as Martin Luther King Jr. said, "The time is always right to do what is right." And as God said to Isaiah, "I will give you as a light to the nations." And as Jesus said to us, "You are the light of the world." So let us shine.